Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben, and we are joined, as always, with our super producer, Noel the Racetrack Brown.
Racetrack. Spitfire.
Spitfire. Ooh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, I like that one. How about Noel Track Day Brown?
Ooh, yeah, that's even better.
I don't know. We'll have to, maybe we'll work on it throughout the episode.
Yeah, yeah, maybe we will.
It's kind of the latest trend anyways, right?
While we're asking ourselves what a suitable nickname for Noel is, it's kind of appropriate in this podcast because, ladies and gentlemen, today we are starting the show with a question that we are going to answer to the best of our ability. However, you may have your own answer. You may have exceptions. You may have issues.
I'm already laughing because I have the impression that we're not really going to answer this question. I don't know if we can answer this question because of the way that the lines have been blurred between the types of vehicles that we're going to talk about today.
Yes.
And I think we've talked about this in the very recent past with what really makes a luxury car a luxury car.
Right. And we've also talked about what makes a muscle car a muscle car.
Sure. Yeah.
Right?
We've had a few of these along the way where, a strict definition given by one, enthusiast group or, maybe even a dictionary, is now being kind of that line is kind of being muddied. It's being jostled around a bit so that your expectations of what a vehicle should be if it's in this class or category is different than what you may get now versus what you got decades ago.
Oh, here's one. Noel the Belgian Brown.
That's going, you know what?
That's a little foreshadowing.
That is foreshadowing. And, okay, there's a whole conversation we had ahead of this, but, but we will, we'll work Belgium into this topic here with sports cars too.
Yeah, we promise. Oh, yes. And Noel, could we please have some big important question music? Perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, today's question, one of the great questions in automotive history, what makes a sports car?
Mm-hmm. So what in people's mind do they picture? I would guess that most of our listeners, when we say, what is a sports car?
Yeah, they think of, you think of maybe an F1, right?
Well, yeah, or they think of like a, maybe not that, maybe they think of like a Corvette, or maybe they think of here's a trick one, a Mustang. Or maybe they think of, this is some other model that that is like cemented in their mind as being a sports car. But along the way somewhere, throughout history, people have again kind of taken this idea and said, no, you know what, here's what a sports car really should be. And then it changes over time because manufacturers come up with cars that kind of blur the lines, as I said.
Right, yeah, that go from one category of car to another. There are some great comparisons we can talk about too, but first, if we could open from a definition, Scott, I'd like to start there.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. Merriam-Webster defines a sports car as a low, small, usually two-passenger automobile designed for quick response, easy maneuverability, and high-speed driving. Now, we can add a bunch of stuff to that. You know, people might say usually it's a two-seater.
Sure, yeah, they could say that, and they could also say, well, it has to be rear-wheel drive.
Right, yeah.
This is the problem with all the stuff that I'm going to mention, because I've got this list here, Ben, and the list isn't a list of cars. It's more a list of my own questions.
Oh, great,
And I want you to think about these maybe throughout the podcast, and we can even stop and dwell on a couple of these if you want to. But
for sure.
Let's get this out of the way, too. Manufacturers make cars that are sporty. They make cars that have sporting characteristics to them, like tossability, that you can quickly throw it into a corner.
Sure,
or
sure.
Go-kart handling, like Mini likes to say.
Or it has a great acceleration.
Exactly right. Yeah, but how do you measure that? Acceleration is one thing. So 0 to 60, that's fine.
Sure, sure.
But do you measure it? Do you measure top speed as well? Do you measure engine RPMs?
Mm-hmm.
All these things come into play. So I've got a million questions here. Not really a million, but, a bunch.
Lay them on me.
And I'm sure that our listeners are going to be able to add several to this whole thing. So the first one is, does it have to have two seats? Could one seat be a sports car as well? Because there are not many of them out there, but there's some great one-seat cars that are definitely considered sports cars.
Yeah.
So one seat is possible. Now, what if you say three? Is it possible to have three seats and be a sports car?
Yes, but then that also goes to another question. What is the difference between, should we separate supercars from sports cars.
Oh, okay. So,
you know what I mean?
Okay, I know exactly where you're going with this, because three seats implies the McLaren F1 from the early 1990s, or I guess through the 1990s.
Yeah.
And that is clearly a sports car.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about. So what do you think of when you think of a sports car?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's three seats. You know, there's a central driving position.
Which is so cool.
And two passengers that flank the driver. Clearly a sports car. No other intent, really.
Right.
It's not a luxury car. It's not all that other stuff
we talked about.
Well, maybe it is a luxury to be able to afford one. But that's definitely a sports car. And people would argue that it definitely is. But it has three seats, so it doesn't meet the classic definition of a sports car.
Right.
And we're going to find things like that along the way, all throughout. Does it have to be rear-wheel drive?
Right.
I don't know. What about all-wheel drive? Does that count as a sports car? Because a lot of Subaru drivers will argue that they've got sports cars. And so will Audi drivers that have the Quattro system and other manufacturers that make great all-wheel drive systems.
Can a sedan be a sports car, or can it only aspire to be sporty?
Ah, well, okay. But how about this? What about the ones that are the four-door coupes, supposedly, which you can't really, four-door coupe is a funny thing to say, I know.
Right,
But a lot of cars are considered four-door coupes and have a sporty look because they've completely changed the roof line of those things so that they're not really high in the back like they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
They have very little room in the back, for headroom. But the design, the exterior design of the car is decidedly sporty.
Yeah, it's very much the sports car profile. But then we go into the area of what one of my pet peeves, Scott, and you know this, listeners, you probably know this too. I don't like token back seats.
I think they're
disingenuous.
Oh, so you're talking about there are some cars I think that even have like fold down seats that, if you need it, you can put it back up because it's connected to the trunk area. Or, maybe the ones that have seats that, well, it's 2+2 seating really.
Yes, that's probably the best way to put it.
And the best one that I can think of, and I had this on my list somewhere here that I'll come up with, but the Lotus Evora. And the Lotus Evora back seat, that's that comically small back seat.
It's
described as 2+2 seating, which we know is two adults in the front, two kids in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say two kids in the back, preferably kids in car seats so that their legs don't have to hang down between the back seat and the driver's seat or the passenger seat.
Right, right.
Because it's way, way too small.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the best example of a token back seat I can think of in the modern era. I mean, right now. I know Porsche has a couple of cars that have some token back seats as well.
So what are some of these other questions?
All right. So does cylinder count matter? I mean, what if you have a 4-cylinder, a 6-cylinder, an 8-cylinder, or more? Does it have to have a certain amount of cylinders?
Mm-hmm.
That one I'm not entirely sure about, because some of the earliest sports cars that we brought over to the United States, the returning, this whole thing that we've talked about in the past with returning veterans from the war, from World War II.
Yeah.
They were in Europe, they saw the MGs, the Triumphs, the Jaguars, and they loved those cars, the sports cars. Two seats, 4 cylinders often. I mean, Jaguar's a little different, but they would bring over these 4-cylinder cars that were manual transmissions. They had very thin tires, but they were fun to drive. They had a convertible top. It was just an exciting little car.
Great handling.
Compared to what was being made here in the United States at the time. So that's what they appreciated those vehicles, decided to bring them back with them. That really led to a trend here in the United States as well.
Don't let me roll over you with this one, but as soon as we're mentioning the idea of an absolute number of cylinders, I feel that we are verging very close to making an error in our definition because of the evolution of technology over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's much easier now, given the vast improvements just in engineering alone, not even counting material science. It's much easier now for a 4-cylinder engine built now to just cream a 4-cylinder engine from that time.
Oh, of course, And think about the new, what's the Ford GT, the brand new supercar that they're going to come out with in 2017, I think it is.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, V6.
Yeah.
But it's going to have, of course, turbo V6. It's the EcoBoost V6, I believe. And it's going to have an enormous amount of horsepower. I want to say it's like, I don't even know if I should make a guess here. I think the street car is going to have 680 horsepower. The track car, of course, is going to have much more, like closer to 1,000 horsepower, something like that. But that's coming out of a V6 engine. So clearly we're making huge advancements in the way that, engines and, I mean, of course, this all goes with machining. We have precise machines that allow for extremely high compression. Everything is well put together, extremely well put together and strong. And We've talked about this many, many times, so I don't know if we need to go much further down this path, but let's keep going with some of these questions that I have. Does it have to be small? I mean, I don't think it has to be small.
I mean,
that's great to have a tiny car, you know, that's very nimble, very agile, you know, that you can really kind of work around the turns in a backcountry road somewhere. But, some of these bigger, like, I guess, supercar type vehicles, you know, that are considered sports cars, some of them, they're just as agile, just as nimble, but, you know, they're much bigger platform that they start with. And yeah, it's different to drive, sure, but does it have to be a certain size to be considered a sports car?
Right. Again, we're running into absolutes. Is there a certain length past which something cannot be considered a sports car, a certain weight past which something cannot be considered a sports car?
How about this, Ben? Going back to the powertrains, how about a hybrid? A hybrid sports car. Now,
oh man,
I don't try to argue this one away, Ben, because we talked about a few of these cars on our own podcast. What about the McLaren P1? I'm going to even throw the Fisker Karma in here, only, you know, because I saw one this morning, and what a fantastic looking car. Yeah, it's still pretty rare to see, here in this area.
Was it the same one from the shows?
I'm going to have to guess that it was one of the ones from the shows that we saw. Yeah, so check out our videos.
They're just so rare.
Yeah,
we have a video on it.
They're pretty rare, and I saw it on the road just before I had to exit the highway this morning. Didn't get to see the license plate or anything, know which one it was. But
I am going to try to argue, though.
Okay.
Just really quickly.
Okay.
For people who've checked out our various podcasts that touch on hybrid racing or even electric racing, we address something, I guess it's a little more intangible, an abstract concept, which is that when you think of not necessarily a sports car, but when you think of racing, I'm thinking specifically of hybrid racing, if you're nostalgic for it, it's a different category. It's not quite the same. There's just something there about the engine, the sound of the internal combustion kicking in, the roar.
You know the camp that I'm in on this. I mean, I like the old, F1 roar,
right,
of course, but not the current. See, that's the thing. The current F1 engines aren't all that great sounding.
That's true,
They're
going
to get back to it, I think. But, you know, you're talking about like Formula E racing versus Formula One racing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in other categories, like let's say it's different big events, even endurance events, they're going to have categories that have hybrid racers. So far, I haven't seen an entire race field made out of hybrid vehicles.
I haven't either.
I haven't come across that. It's probably out there. There's probably a hybrid racing league somewhere, but I don't know exactly what that would entail. So I know exactly what you're talking about, though. Like that quality that you just can't put your finger on. Like, why is this not quite as entertaining to watch as would be a standard Formula One race?
It's up there with the feel of a luxury car, right?
Yeah, it's a similar thing. It's tough to put a finger on exactly what makes that different for you.
So, okay, I guess, you know what, man, because I'm also thinking of Tesla in this too. I guess you could say there's an argument to be made that it could be a sports car without an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah. What about, did you mention this one, the Tesla Roadster?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
All right, that's one. And then, you know, there was going to be another car that we're going to talk about in a future podcast called the Detroit Electric Car. And that was really that's a Tesla that's electrified by a company called Detroit Electric, but Tesla did it, you know, a decade ago.
Right.
So I don't know why they're even bothering with this, but we're still hearing about that. It's a little bit of vaporware. But, all right, some other quick things here that I'm thinking of, then we can go into some other stuff. Okay, here's an interesting one. Does it have to be a convertible? Because some people believe that it has to be a drop-top roadster in order to, be a sports car.
No, I don't agree. I think that's a kind of sports car.
I agree. So here's the thing, though. So are all roadsters sports cars, and are all sports cars roadsters? I don't think that one goes either way.
Yeah.
I don't think that one. Well, but I think a lot of people do feel like a sports car needs to be a convertible.
Well, if you want a sports car that is a convertible, then by all means get one. But here's the thing about a convertible. It doesn't have the same impact on performance. It's more of, an aesthetic part.
In fact, it's a detriment because oftentimes you'll find that by removing the roof, you add weight to the mechanism that is required to handle the roof once it's folded down, and as well as you're costing yourself with aerodynamics.
See, that's what I'm saying. It's an aesthetic thing, and so if you define a sports car purely by that kind of aesthetic stuff, there's a slippery slope there, my friends, because if we start with that one definition, it's like that old, it's like that old children's book, if you give a mouse a cookie, because then the next thing we're going to be talking about is going to be, well, what kind of tires is it allowed to have, right? And tires, I think, are a much better case because tires have a much more, significant impact on performance. For better or worse. But then we'd say, oh, well, like, wait, What kind of headlights? What's the front end look like? Tell me about how the back end, what's the general shape? Oh, and then, real sports cars are only red.
Okay. But you know what I mean? But all of this stuff that we're talking about, just about everything here, transforms over time. I mean, the manufacturers, they create better tires. They make the shapes a little more aerodynamic and better. So is the shape of the car as interesting as it was back in the 1970s when they first started making that car, 1960s or 1950s even? Maybe not. Maybe they're not even making it anymore, but they found a better way along the way, or they think they found a better way along the way. And it might remove some of that sporty look of the vehicle. It might enhance it. There's so many different angles to all this stuff. So how about this?
Okay.
Practicality. Does a sports car have to be non-practical to be a true sports car? Because there are a lot of cars that, okay, how about this one? Here's one that, and I think we can disqualify this one right away, but people at Porsche aren't going to agree. The Porsche Panamera. Now, it's a four-door, four seats, but it's a Porsche. I mean, it looks like one of their other models just stretched out, really, in the middle. That's all. I mean, that's really the only difference in the whole thing. I mean, there's a little bit of difference. I get that. But people will consider that one not a sports car. It might be a sports sedan, and there are sports coupes.
Right.
And see, there's these different kind of crossover categories. And I hate that term crossover, by the way. But there's a lot of different crossover categories that these sports cars, or what we thought of as sports cars, kind of fit into now.
Well, doesn't the – but okay. Yes, I disqualify the Panamera, with no bad blood to the folks at Porsche, but it's, to me, it has negative 10 points already because it's a sedan. And then it also has, here's the kicker, Porsche describes it as a luxury vehicle.
Really?
Yeah, as a luxury four-door sedan.
Okay. I'm having a hard time distinguishing the two because it, to me, I mean, it's a giant car. It looks like a Porsche.
It does.
It definitely fits the Porsche line.
Sure.
I mean, it matches their styling.
It's got a mean engine. It's got that V8.
And it seems like it would be a blast to drive. I've seen people who have reviewed these and said, you know, it's a fun car to drive despite its size. But see, there's always that asterisk after it.
It's like,
this car handles really well, even though, you know, whatever, the two seats behind me, or the length of the vehicle, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, or the weight of the vehicle.
This is a fantastic car for what it is.
Yeah, well, there's always that, right? There's always that angle.
Caveat.
So, all right, so there's that, you know, the practicality. And there's probably another dozen or so cars out there right now. I mean, think about sports cars, cars that people consider as sports cars that they use as a daily driver. I mean, that would be one. And other cars that people consider a sports car, like some Mustangs, which I know they're not going to like to hear that again, but that's true. And
shots fired.
But, well, honestly, God, those are great performing cars, but they're pony cars.
Yeah.
That's a pony car.
Through and through.
But no one ever uses the term pony car anymore. Not really. I mean, outside of, you know, this, like an enthusiast group, or maybe within Road and Track or something, when they're comparing pony cars.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, I've got a few other ideas that I arrived at via comparison.
Okay.
And I think we're getting toward it when we talk about practicality.
Sure.
Right? So ordinary cars, what we consider daily drivers, are built with a few common things in mind. Normally it's going to be something like safety, consistency, fuel economy or thriftiness, right?
Yeah.
And then consideration for space, whether that's for passengers or cargo. And those both kind of fall under the idea of comfort and efficiency. But sports cars sacrifice almost all of that for the pursuit of performance and handling and acceleration, you know, so you're not really going to have a huge trunk. You're not going to have seats for five, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to have
Well, it's a give and take.
Yeah, it's a give and take.
I mean, you know that you're only going to have two seats. You're not going to be able to take the family on a trip in this car.
Sure, performance is the priority.
Sure, you know you're not going to be able to take the golf clubs to the golf course in this car unless you don't have a passenger and you put them in the passenger seat.
Mm-hmm.
You're simply not going to have the trunk space to do that in most vehicles. Now, unless you get a car that has, you know, a specific space set aside for something like that. You know, the manufacturers designed that, you know, for long cargo or whatever. And that happens occasionally. I get that happens.
Sure.
But efficiency, I mean, come on. That's one that shouldn't even really come to mind when you're talking about buying a true sports car, I think.
And, which is what's sticky to me about the hybrid stuff.
Okay.
Honestly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, okay. I don't think that they're doing it. What's your opinion? Do you think they're doing it because of CAFE standards? I can't even say it with a straight face. They're not doing it because of CAFE standards.
Ooh, they might be.
I don't know. I mean, maybe in a manufacturer that only makes two or three models,
right,
and one of them happens, you know, this is, let's say, McLaren.
Okay.
And they have to meet CAFE standards to be able to import here to the United States.
Yeah, I don't think that's the overarching, I don't think that's the biggest factor.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
I believe that the move to hybrid engines is arising partially because the technology is increasingly there. It's closer and closer to what it needs to be. I don't think it's there yet, to be candid.
Well, it's pretty impressive what they do in their top-end models, the ones that are, you know, $1 million plus.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the LaFerrari and look at the P1 that I keep mentioning,
mm-hmm,
the Porsche 918 Spyder. That's an impressive one right there
as well.
That
is, okay.
So there's one right there.
You're selling me.
And by the way, Lamborghini is soon to come out with its own hybrid model. And,
mm-hmm,
and I got to tell you, I don't think Lamborghini is doing that because they really feel like they're saving the earth with a hybrid model or anything.
No.
There's probably a reason. There are benefits to it is that, you know, the immediate torque, of course, mm-hmm, able to stuff two motors in the front wheels and still have a gasoline engine power in the rear wheels.
This is the Asterion, right?
Yeah, that's right. And was it 2019 or something like that? It's way out still. But I don't feel like they're doing it for, you know, the save the earth purposes that, mm-hmm, Nissan is doing it with, mm-hmm, the Leaf. I think that they're doing it because, to be quite honest, because McLaren's done it, Ferrari's done it, Porsche's done it.
I think there's a lot of that too.
We need to have something in that market space, and that's why we're doing it. So, of course, there are benefits, but you can't really stuff something like that into the car without making it, you know, exponentially more expensive. Because I think the Lamborghini that's coming out in 2019, they're projecting like $500,000 for that thing.
Yeah, and that's another question.
What's that?
Is there a certain threshold of cost that would make the difference between a sports car and a supercar, or should we even separate supercar and sports car?
Going back to the simple MGs and Triumphs,
yeah,
and you know, the Jaguars and stuff.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean the early Jaguars, the ones that weren't $100,000, the ones in the 1950s. I mean, they're expensive, but not. Well, that's another topic. Going back to that simplicity, that just fun to drive, tossable vehicle that was lightweight, had a four-cylinder engine, but it had a manual transmission. It was unforgiving, but it was fun to drive. And once you learn how to drive it, you could really drive it well,
mm-hmm,
and just have a good time with it. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. And this blurred line, this kind of intangible experience that people have when they're in these cars. I mean, that you can drive a car that's not necessarily a sports car,
mm-hmm,
but it is sporty. Or it has some level of sportiness built into it by the manufacturer, and they know that. I mean, look at Mini. All the Mini cars, they've got rear seats. I think there might be one that's a two-seater. Isn't the coupe a two-seater? I'll look it up as
I'll say it honestly. Guys, you know I'm not the biggest fan of Minis.
Yeah, well, Minis maybe.
Okay, old Minis are great. Again, I've said it before, but just don't call it a Mini and make it bigger and bigger and bigger. You know
okay.
what I mean?
All right. Well, so I got a question for you then, because
right.
I just recently had this discussion with my wife.
Okay.
What's your opinion on the old Mini? I mean, the classic Minis, you know, the 1950s through the 1970s Mini, or 1980s, I guess, in some parts of the world, but not here. What's your thought on those? Do you like the original, or do you like the first generation of the Mini that came over to the United States recently. I don't remember what year
that
was.
Right. I prefer the old one. I'll be honest with you. I prefer the old one. Neither of them are really the car for me. But just in terms of looks, I'm usually going to go with the older one. That's not to say that the the new wave, the resurrection of minis or resurgence of what they have here in the States. Mm-hmm. So I don't say it's necessarily bad. I just think at some point you have to ask yourself, how different can this vehicle become before it is no longer what, you know, it originally was inspired by?
That's true. Yeah. And that's why a lot of people, I think there's a fair amount of people that feel like, yeah, it has grown a little bit out of control over the last couple of generations, mm-hmm. a couple of releases. You can park them side by side and see them grow.
I mean, yeah, and maybe I'm just being a cranky old man, but like, get off my lawn.
I guess we're both in that camp though, but several people are the same way. I have to say that I'm a fan of the original minis. Now, the Cooper S versions, of course, you know, the John Works Coopers those great vehicles, you know, they were, I guess, sort of sports cars. I mean, they probably were considered sports cars, but they had a back seat, a small back seat, but that sat two people. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily like the fastest cars on the road by any means. I mean, there were a lot of other vehicles out there that you could choose that were a little bit more expensive, a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But it was a fun to drive car that was small. It was something that it's kind of like the everyman car.
Yeah, but that's sporty at best, right?
Yeah, sporty, sure. Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's it. Yeah, it's a sporty version of the car. It's not necessarily a sports car. It never really was considered a sports car, I don't think.
No, I would hope not.
Well, but you know what? The people that drive them might think that. They might think that's a sports car, as would people that drive a Camaro SS or that drive, I keep picking on Mustangs, but I shouldn't. but the people who drive a Mustang GT, they might think that. Now, what about Corvette drivers? That's a sports car. Right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think there's anyone denying that that's a sports car.
No, I hope
That meets all the criteria that we're talking about.
And we're going to have an interesting conversation, too. This is a little bit of a spoiler alert. Listeners, in a bit, you're going to hear an episode coming from us in the next few weeks where we talk about some of the most anticipated cars of the coming year.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about crossover, talk about blending categories of cars. We're going to be living in some interesting times, and people being car manufacturers are taking some big risks, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. But we'll see if it evolves, if it ever comes out, really.
That's true. We're still at that point. Every time you're waiting on something to come out, you can find yourself in an Alio Motors situation.
That's a good way to put it.
Shots fired. Yeah. But here's a quote that I read that I think we can all appreciate. There was a comment in a forum that said, sports cars are a matter of perspective, especially considering that, I'm paraphrasing here, that technology means some of those trade-offs aren't as absolute or mm-hmm. black and white as they once were.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the point. Like, a modern V6 Camry is faster than a 1980s Ferrari 308.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, well, I buy that. Sure.
But no one would... no one would really say, if you had to choose which of these is a sports car, no one's going to point to the Camry over that Ferrari.
No, so you're saying park them side by side, and of course people are going to point at the Ferrari and say that's the sports car, and not point at the, would you say it was a Nissan or a Toyota? What was it?
A Camry.
Toyota Camry. Come on. Did you have to go with the Camry? Because there's probably 100 cars out there right now that exceed that performance level.
Sure.
In whatever, you know, parameters that you want to put on that, whether it's 0 to 60, whether it's top speed, whatever it happens to be, maybe just outright horsepower and torque numbers. Man, that's really, I mean, that shows you exactly how we're advancing. And we talked about, you know, the new engine technologies, how these V6 engines or even, you know, turbo 4-cylinder engines are besting 8-cylinder engines. But that's going way, way back too. Think about those giant V12 engines or the huge V8s that powered cars in the 20s and 30s that, the horsepower and torque rate. Now, torque was high on those, but the horsepower, not so much there. So they
not in modern context.
No, but they weren't really going for speed or anything like
that. And that Ford we were just talking about, I think it's like an estimated 600 horsepower or something.
For the GT?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 680 for the street, and I want to say close to 1,000 for the track.
That's
something like that.
Crazy.
Yeah, and that's a V6.
Okay, here's another thing. When we were talking, to go back to aesthetic stuff, scoops, spoilers, stuff like that. Can we agree that those are not necessary components of a sports car?
Well, okay, that depends. I think that it's based on engine design, and then of course some cars that had RAM air systems that were functional.
Yeah,
there are a lot of cars
so
that
you might need the scoops.
You might, sure. And what about spoilers on the back that are functional versus the ones that you can buy at Pep Boys?
Man,
last night I saw a 350, a Nissan 350Z.
Okay,
and it was in front of me. It was dark. It was nighttime, raining. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. About two or three cars ahead of me in the rain. It's a black car. But it had one of those spoilers on the back that's like 4 feet in the air. I mean, way, way up in the air. Like,
why?
I don't know. I don't know if it's functional or not. I mean, of course, the car sounded great. It had
the performance exhaust as well.
And you had nice big wide tires, and it was dropped and everything. But I don't know if that was a really functional wing or not. I couldn't tell you.
Or if it was just for the look.
Yeah, could have been held on with two flimsy little wood screws in the back, and that's it. But you see that kind of stuff out there. You see like, that Saturn that I talked about one time that had like a vent on the passenger cabin area.
Uh-huh.
And it's not functional. It's just it's sitting on top there.
But then
it's their car. Exactly right. Yeah. I think we've talked about add-ons in the past too.
Whether
they're functional, whether they're not functional. But I do feel that in certain sports cars, like you have to keep the engine cool.
That's absolutely true.
Instances of this, I think that's fine. Others, I don't know. Like some of the splitters and things like that people put on their street cars,
mm-hmm.
not necessary, but it looks pretty cool.
Well, and I think we can all agree that the one thing all sports cars have, when you get past all the things that we could argue about for all of this episode and more episodes, there is one thing that every sports car is required to have, both legally, I would say ethically, even aesthetically.
What is that?
Perhaps morally. Whistle tips.
You really had me hooked there. I thought you were going to come up with something that I'm going to say, like, oh, yeah, you're right. Exactly. Whistle tips. Yeah.
Pretty soon you won't even need a driver.
Yep. Nope.
Just have those tips.
Yep. Just a good old bub rub as your friend.
Yeah. So I bring that up, and I know it's such a sidebar, but I bring it up because I was showing some of our coworkers the whistle tips video, and one of them was convinced that it was sketch comedy. He said, no, this is from a morning show years ago.
That's an actual report. Just a guy they happened to cross. It was Bub Rub.
Bub Rub.
Bub Rub and Little Sis, right?
Little Sis, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's been a while since I've seen that one, but
quality clip. So I am joking about that, but I do think that one of the biggest things we're talking about would be weight to power ratio, and then rear wheel drive is hugely important.
Okay.
I don't know if you can really say, I don't know if you can say that a car that is exclusively front wheel drive would be a true sports car, because it may be a true sports car, something you take on the track,
mm-hmm.
right?
You can
drive on the track when you buy it factory.
Sure.
Like you don't have to buy an extra package to get it, to make it a track day car.
Sure. Yeah.
And then if we're talking about being on the track, then rear wheel drive is going to be superior.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a preference, but you can race a front wheel drive vehicle. You can race an all wheel drive vehicle. What about the Honda Civic Type R that's coming out?
Oh, yeah.
What about the Golf Type R, GTI Type R?
Well, the Honda Civic is finally coming to America.
Yeah, that's true.
It's probably a
better reason. That's true. Well, I mean, but
it doesn't impact the argument you're making. That's true.
Well, so think about this, though. People that buy that vehicle, I mean, they're going to feel like they're in a sports car. They feel like they've just purchased a sports car because of the way that thing is going to perform.
Especially if they were driving an older model regular Civic.
Well, sure. Yeah, of course they will. Or, you know what, honestly, just about anything else, because that's going to be a strong performer. But
mm-hmm.
It's going to be fun to drive. And that's the thing. That's the
intangible part.
Exactly right. That's the intangible part. It's going to be a blast to drive. When you get in, it's going to make you smile.
And isn't that a Turbo 4 engine?
I believe it is, yes.
So there we go. I think that... That's a pretty good argument, honestly, Scott, is because the Type R is – I would say it's sporty, though. I wouldn't say it's an out-and-out sports car.
Okay. I would buy that. I would buy that it's sporty or has some level of sportiness built into it by the manufacturer, as the definition
right.
would say, or people that would argue the definition would say. This is all really difficult to quantify. But there are some places that try to do so.
Ah, yes.
And I've come across sort of a funny document here. Now, it wasn't intended to be funny, but it kind of is when you read through it. And there's no way that I can cover this whole thing, so I will just maybe point you in the right direction, and you can look this up for yourself. But we'll briefly discuss this.
A little bit of background, Scott, as we go into this. This is the reason we gave Noel a nickname, and there's a very strange story that you ran across.
Yeah, Ben, there's I guess we'll call it a scholarly article.
Yeah.
That is all about what is a sports car. And this comes from a couple of researchers who are from different universities. One is from the University of Brussels in Belgium. And the other one who participated in this was from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School in Pennsylvania. And they collaborated on this document. And the idea was that they're going to try to find a way to classify all the cars that were in Belgium. Now, this is because Belgium has the ability to import cars from all over the world. They've got all the European brands and marks to choose from, you know, just about from everywhere, really.
They also have a very complex bureaucracy.
Yeah. Well, here's just a scope of what they're dealing with here. There's a potential for them to choose one of 581 different car models in Belgium. So you've got an option of almost 600 different types of vehicles in Belgium, but there's no way to say which ones are sports cars. Now, why would you even really care about that? Because of all that stuff we just talked about, right?
Right.
And this study, by the way, I should say, the best I can determine, I can't even find a year on this thing when it was done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it was done in the early 1990s based on some of the citations that they have at the end of the study that are from the late 1980s.
Yes.
All right. So, 600 cars. They're trying to determine a way to find out if they're a quote, normal car, or a sports car. And the reason all this comes about, Ben, you probably know the reason, right?
This is just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's for taxes. It's a way to, increase the insurance on the sports cars versus the cars that are, you know, quote unquote normal. So it's all about finding a way to tax and to, add costs onto, some of the policies of people that are driving cars that should be considered sports cars in their mind.
Right.
So how do you do that based on everything we just talked about? Because these questions have been floating around for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, because before, didn't they say the insurers in Belgium used a variable called vehicles of a sporting nature?
Yeah.
Which is not quite.
Yeah, so what does that mean, right? I mean, you got to figure out what vehicles of a sporting nature means and how do they do this. So This is what's funny, and this is why you should look this up, because there's a formula, and you can look at this formula, and it's a confusing formula, it's a math formula, and there's no way I'm going to even be able to describe what this formula looks like, but it's a very short formula. It's like W over P, the square root of 3 over S divided by 4 cc's is less than 17. That's the way they determine this. Now, what all that means, and you'll have to again look at this all, but the variables, the parameters here, W is the weight of the car in kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
P is the power of the engine, which is described as DIN horsepower, which is kind of like metric horsepower, really, measured at the output shaft. S is the number of seats in the vehicle, and CC is the engine capacity in liters. Now, all that has to be less than 17, and then that means that the vehicle is of a sporting nature if the number that you get from that formula is less than 17.
So, and this is a little bit weird because there's some history behind it. This formula, they didn't necessarily make it up. It dates all the way back to the 70s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it came from somewhere. A Formula One driver, I believe, a Belgian Formula One driver created this formula to determine, which vehicles should be considered sports cars on the road. And that's the old way of doing things. They are trying to, this paper, this scholarly, academic writing, is trying to find a new way to measure the vehicles that are in Belgium. So, clearly they have a huge problem with the cars that are in Belgium.
Right. They pointed out to that there were a couple of readily apparent flaws in the formula. It's very sensitive to the number of seats, which we had talked about. It doesn't take into account some of the technical innovations, right? Because it's from the 70s.
Sure.
And my favorite of their big criticisms are, quote, the use of third and fourth roots has no physical justification. which sounds like I could see these two guys racking their brains and going, why? why do you have these roots on here?
Yeah, it seems kind of silly. But honestly, I mean, when you look at the parameters that they're using, it's not so bad, really. When they look at weight, they look at power, they look at the number of seats, the engine capacity, it kind of fits in or ties into the classic definition of a sports car. So they're trying to find a way to determine which what so that they can add, and get this, 40% on top of basic premium costs to individuals that own vehicles that fit the sporting nature, I guess.
And by the way, that does not apply to other vehicles.
No, and there's a huge list. Now, they do have all 581 charted out here, and there's lots of charts and graphs, and it'll make you go cross-eyed looking at it. What they did, however, in this study, so if you do open it, you'll find that you can look at about 100. You can look at about 100 examples from their 600 and look at the cars that they determine as sporty versus not sporty. And just, I don't know if we can even give a few examples here, because they broke it down really, really far into 10 different, no, there's 12 different categories in this, in this chart, this big matrix that they created of sports cars versus normal cars.
Right.
And strange, I mean, like some of the Fiat cars that we would consider probably as sporty or even sports cars qualify as normal vehicles under this. And then other cars that you would think of as not necessarily a sports car do qualify as sports cars. Like there's a Ford Fiesta that's on there as a sports car, but it's the XR2 model. So maybe that's what makes the difference. There's, let's see, a Volkswagen Scirocco, the standard Scirocco, doesn't come up as a sports car. However, the GT and GTX models do come up as a sports car. It's just a fascinating list to look at. And really, it's quickly, you can quickly go through it, because the final column here, the 12th column, is the one that denotes that. Either they get a zero or a one. One is a sports car. Zero is just a normal car, an average car.
It is strange when you see that Fiesta. And it's also, it's based on the best quantitative analysis they could do, and they mess around with the formula a little bit to try to improve on it, right? So they put in measurements for maximum torque. That's a big one.
Sure.
Maximum engine speed, RPM, and those, even just adding those two, I think gives us a more sophisticated understanding of it.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, man, I was amazed when you showed this to me. There really is an academic paper for everything.
Yeah, and take a look at it. I mean, just even if you just quickly scroll through this paper, it's worth a look and worth a read just to see what it's all about. It's kind of funny in some ways. Other ways you're thinking like, well, this is all about how to really charge more money for certain for certain drivers on the road. And I guess a lot of people were probably pretty irked at that when they got nicked with an extra 40% on their premium. Also, you know, if you make a claim, they were saying that, you know, the claims for these sports cars is often a lot higher. So there's a lot of justification for why they're doing this. But then again, there's also a lot of reasons why they maybe just shouldn't mess with it. Maybe they should just, you know, leave it alone.
And this is a tip for the Belgians in the audience. Do check out this paper before you purchase your next car.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, well, it's an older list, of course, so I don't know how much this really pertains. Because, I mean, they've got, like, the Bertone X19 model.
Yeah.
You know, the Saab Sonnets and things like that on the list, you know, that aren't around anymore. So
that's true. Might need to write to the docs and see if we can get an updated list.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but it's kind of interesting to look through. Okay, the Lamborghini Countach is on this list, so that gives you an idea of how old it is, right? All right, so, and clearly that's a sports car.
Right.
But the Maserati Quattroporte is not a sports car. It's fun to look at that and just see, you know, what's there, and I'm sure that you can find the full 600 somewhere.
And if it matches if the cars you think are or are not sports cars are, you know, jibing with this list.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, everybody's going to read this a slightly different way. They're going to look at it and they're going to raise their eyebrows like, what? That's not a sports car? And the other ones are going to say, kind of scrunch their brow and say, I don't think so. I don't think that one qualifies. And then go take a look at the photo of it and it's like, nah, that's not a sports car. But it meets the criteria based on the new formula that they've created. So they've got a new formula.
There's a method to the madness.
Yeah, so that's 1971 formula that I mentioned earlier has been changed. It's been adapted.
Retooled.
With a lot more variables. A few more variables, I guess. Yeah, but just a further way to break things down in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and this is our...
Read that however you want.
This was our best find for a quantitative measurement or definition of a sports car that wasn't just a matter of perspective.
Yeah. Seems like mostly it just should be like a seat of the pants thing. I mean, just how you feel about your vehicle or
how does it drive?
Yeah. I mean, you may drive something that has, you know, two more seats behind you, has a four cylinder engine, but man, is that thing fun to drive. And to you, that's a sports car. I say that's perfectly fine. If you, if you feel like your car is a sports car, why not? Why not? Right. I mean, it won't, maybe it isn't classified as that, but maybe that's good. Maybe you're not being taxed like it's a sports car.
40%, can you believe
it?
Well,
in Belgium, sure.
In Belgium,
well,
yeah.
And you know, here we've got things like, there's gas guzzler taxes and things like that for some of these vehicles that we are talking about.
Higher insurance rates.
Yeah, oh yeah, sure. Higher insurance rates and that, and you know they're looking at stuff like this, you know, what it's considered, what classification.
Oh, yeah.
So, in a way, it's very similar here in the States, and I'm sure that elsewhere around the world, it's similar as well. We're not picking on Belgium by any means, but for them to have this academic paper that clearly defines all this and points it out, I mean, it's interesting.
That's where it comes in, man. It all comes down to the brass tacks of,
all comes down to money. Right?
Yeah.
It's all dollars and cents.
And for some people with sports cars, it all comes down to speed and handling.
Right? Yes.
For the practical rather than the aesthetic applications. We want to know what you think, ladies and gentlemen. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We are CarStuffHSW. We would love to see your opinion of what is and is not a sports car. I think we're going to get a lot more people saying that is not a sports car.
Can I mention just one more quick thing?
Yeah.
What's funny to me when I looked at a lot of lists of what people considered to be sports cars and what other people, you know, would argue against in the in the forum or the you know, the comments below, some people would look at that list and say, "Are you kidding me? You didn't even include a single Lotus vehicle in this whole list of what is a sports car." Almost everything that they make is a sports. What about Panos, the cars we just talked, that whole Panos operation that's here in Georgia?
Yeah.
They only make sports cars and track day cars. You'll find that there are glaring omissions on some lists, and others they're going to have additions that you don't think should be there.
That's a great way to say it.
Strange lists. I mean, you're going to find a ton of them.
How would you list every sports car, though?
You just can't.
That's Herculean.
You can't, because I think I read somewhere that the first sports cars go back to 1910, which is prior to the first use of the word sports car in popular media, which was like in the 1930? 1928?
I think it was 1920. Let me see. It's 1928.
It's the late 1920s. But sports cars clearly had been around for two decades before that, because they're racing on, you know, on tracks like Indianapolis. They're racing all over the world, really. Mm-hmm. There's sports cars. There's sports cars out there, but they just didn't know what to call them until the late 1920s. And they when they put the term on it.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. So we want to hear what you think should and shouldn't be on these lists. This is the time to let us know your pet peeves and your favorites, the ones you're the super fan of. You can check out all the other podcasts that we had mentioned on our website, carstuffshow.com. That's where you can hear about the Panos. So you can hear about the luxury car stuff we mentioned. That's where, well, you know, it's all there.
How about muscle car definitions? You know,
the strict
muscle car definition from, what was the name of that site? It was a funny site.
What?
Oh, musclecarclub.com.
Yeah.
They've got strict definitions for all this.
They were not pulling punches either.
They only list one car as a sports car. And
yeah.
It was the Corvette.
Yes.
You're going to find stuff like this all over the place. And it's really fun to dig into, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, more than you would think.
I think if you think it's going to be a great time, you're exactly right. I think it's fascinating, and I always appreciate hearing someone make a case for or against something in a way that I did not expect.
Yeah.
And if you have a case you'd like to make for or against something considered a sports car or just considered sporty, I'd like to read that too. So go ahead and pull up a computer, not if you're driving. Pull up your email or something, and send Scott, Noel, and I a letter. You can tell us your opinion on what makes a sports car, or muscle cars, after you listen to that episode, of course. Or if you have a suggestion for something we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear that, too. You can email us directly at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.